This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, and I am joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. The week is rushing past.
It just seems to be getting, the closer we get to Christmas, the more ridiculously fast time goes. Or maybe it's just the older we get. I haven't figured that one out yet. Too many Christmases, Sam.
Yes, yes. That thought of it getting faster each year is not a good thing, isn't it? Who are we introducing for coming up for air today?
For coming up for air today, it's my great pleasure to introduce the very lovely Hannah Mason. Welcome, Hannah. It is so nice to have you here today.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me join. Very excited to be a part of this. It's been an awesome experience for us. I'm sure we'll talk about it shortly.
Where are you, Hannah?
I am based in Osatahi, Christchurch. That's where I call home. It's a great place. It's not a great day for me today in terms of the weather, but I'm sure, yeah, wherever you guys are based, it's probably more beautiful.
No. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hawke's Bay, so in the North Island, and then moved to Otago for university, and then slowly making my way back north, with Christchurch home for now.
You might make it back in about 50 years at that rate.
It's at some point, yeah.
So what was it like growing up in the Hawke's Bay?
I loved it. It was great. I grew up in Havelock North, which is quite a small community. Well, probably large compared to where Mawira's from in terms of the communities there. But it was great. Full of lots of produce and farming communities. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I went to a school which had boarding students, a lot of whom were from farming backgrounds. Great place to be, close to the beach, close enough to the mountains. Just a lot of playgrounds in your backyard.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
When I was younger, I actually wanted to be a dietitian, funnily enough. I was very fixated on the obesity issue and loved food, and that's what I originally went to Otago to do, and then quickly decided it was not what I really thought it was all about, which maybe if I had stayed on it would have been, but I decided that no business is where I wanted to go into, and now I work for BNZ as an associate partner in the commercial team in Christchurch, and also I'm doing my master's in sustainable business, which is the area that sustainable finance and sustainable banking is definitely an area I want to kind of lead into, which hopefully this is going to assist with.
What was it attracted you about business?
I think just lots of different opportunities. I guess when it got to that point that I decided that dietitian/human nutrition at that point wasn't for me, what were the other options, and kind of like the unknown, which I guess is also the space that we're in with sustainability at the moment as well. There is just so much unknown of what is to occur, as well as the jobs, like the job that I might have in 5 years' time, whether or not that's even created right now, is an exciting thought for me.
The sustainability that you're doing now, was that already there in you when you went off to do business?
Yeah, I think it was. When I look back, more basic in terms of like my growing up and my background, in terms of we always had veggie gardens at home, and we did have a lifestyle property for quite a large period of my life where we would have home kill as well. We'd have compost. We'd do all of these things that I kind of took for granted as a child, that I thought that was kind of the norm, that everyone did that, whereas now kind of as I'm getting older, I'm realizing that it's not, and in so many places it's so far from the norm of many families in their homes. So I guess it then transferred into other areas of where I kind of saw myself being more sustainable. Fashion probably was another space that when I was younger I probably didn't care so much, whereas now I'm very much more conscious with what I'm buying, and I guess consumerism in general. The older I get, the less I'm buying, and it's definitely more of a necessity basis than a needs basis, and focusing on where I'm getting stuff from. If I can get it secondhand, fantastic, saves my wallet as well as saves the environment at the same time, which is always great. Probably the banker in me there trying to benefit my own balance sheet at the same time, but and then now the sustainability, I look, as part of my job, I assist looking after about 30 customers, most of whom are based in Mid Canterbury, and now is the time that sustainable finance, green finance, is becoming quite a big thing, and people are needing to transition, and a lot of what we're doing is transitional finance, which is exciting to me that people are even coming to the party. They have caught it all about it, that they're willing to talk about it, because it's expensive, and even with it being discounted, it's still expensive for people to make those transitions.
From the outside, the notion of sustainable banking might seem a bit like, it's not quite an oxymoron, but it's heading towards it, like military intelligence. It's like, presumably it's a thing, because you're telling me it's a thing. Did you know it was a thing? Is that what you were aiming for?
When are you referring to, like,
at any time? At any time. Was it like banking, oh, there's a sustainable option, or did you get... So, oh, there's a sustainable flag over there inside the banking tent.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty fresh. Like, sustainable banking is fresh. And so to even question if it's a legitimate thing, fair enough. It's new. And with anything new, you should be questioning. Is it for the right reasons, or are we just all greenwashing like we're seeing in a whole lot of other industries and areas? In terms of me going in that direction, I was already in banking before I started looking into sustainability being a part of my work life. So I actually did a one-off certificate end of 2020, and that kind of stemmed from COVID, funnily enough. I looked back at what I'd done for my degree, and I completed my degree at Otago, my undergraduate, and majoring in international business and a minor in finance. I kind of looked at it and I was like, did that, where I was at the end of 2020 when I was graduating, did that align with kind of my values? And if I was to go back and start again, what would I have chosen that same degree, or would I have chosen something different? And I kind of thought, actually, I probably would have included something sustainability related. However, back in 2016, when I was looking at what I was wanting to do, it didn't really come across as an option or an area in general, whereas now there's so many different offerings within tertiary education for sustainability related areas. And so I looked back and I was like, that's something I wanted to do. So I did a certificate at that point in time online, and it was great, it was exciting, but it wasn't the right time for me to get into full-time study because I'd just got a new job. And then, yeah, fast forward to the beginning of last year, I kind of decided that actually probably no time was going to be the best time to get into full-time study, and I may as well bite the bullet now, because if it's not now, then when would it be? So, yeah. And so I'm still working, sorry. So it's not full-time, it's part-time.
So you raised the question so you can answer it. Are you greenwashing?
Me personally, or banking in general?
Yeah, banking in general. Or you personally, if you like. You've got a plant behind you, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, there's a few of them. They're alive, so well, maybe they're new. Who knows? I actually think genuinely it's not greenwashing, but I can see that there being huge potential for it as it upscales. So right now we've got really stringent requirements and how we go about it. But then also, like, looking at it, a lot of it's, say, transitioning. Cars, for example, we currently are funding PHEVs and EVs, but actually, should we be funding PHEVs or should we just be doing EVs? And then if you go forward even further, are EVs even the best option at the moment? Should they even be classified as a green alternative because of all of the other implications that come with it? So I guess it's, yeah, you look at it from the lens of what's available right now and are we funding the right thing? And for right now, I believe we are funding the right thing, so it's not greenwashing. But if you did take away the regulations and all the other requirements we've got, then I believe that it is an area that could quite easily turn to greenwashing, just to tick a box.
So is transitional financing, is that that's the term you're using, or that's used?
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah.
So is that a thing? I mean, I know you haven't just made it up in the last 5 minutes, but is that that's a recognised thing?
So I would say a lot of what we're doing would be for transitional purposes. So, for example, we may have carbon reduction being a key area that clients are wanting to reduce. So I had one client last year, I think it was, who did a massive project which ECA actually half funded with the bank funding, the other half through green finance, and it was to transition their coal boiler to wood chip boiler, because it was determined that was a better alternative overall for environmental measures. And so that was great to see that they actually came to us. They're like, hey, we're eligible for this grant, would you consider it to be green financing available to us? And we assessed it, we got all the information, and it made sense, so we continued with that. And I guess as we go forward, then potentially there'll be other alternatives that will come about, but for now that was the most green option available for them, that the coal option was not appropriate, and that the alternative that they could have for a reasonable amount of money, I must say, was to transition to wood chip.
So what's the advantage of calling it green financing if I'm applying for money for something? Does it change the criteria you're using?
So, yeah, in terms of what we say, and I guess I have to be careful, because at some point I would have to give my full disclosure of financial advice.
This is in
jargon,
theory.
But just in general, to consider it green lending, it has to meet one of our areas that we have assigned. So, for example, clean transportation is an area that we have said this is what we would fund green finance for. And so you get the green tag assigned to the loan itself, which then gives you a decreased interest rate. So you're benefiting there because it's cheaper for you. But then in terms of the banking sector, why green finance is good for them is we're going to be regulated shortly on how much of our debt is going towards right things versus how much of it is going into not so good activity. So I can see that we're going to upscale quite quickly, but for now it's getting there. We're seeing more movement, but it's definitely, a lot of people are doing more simple transitions within their work, such as upgrading their fleet from full petrol diesel to hybrids or fully electric.
You know how when you apply for money for a house or something, then for 3 months before you go to the bank, you have to like stop drinking coffee and sort your finances out and behave. Do you see an equivalent attempt to behave in a sustainable space?
That's quite funny. So that was the case maybe 2 years ago when the triple CFA requirements came out, and it was very much like we will go through, not necessarily me because it wasn't my role, but in home lending they would go through your bank statements line by line, item by item, being like, are they spending outside of their means? Which is not the case anymore. It is definitely they've realized, or the government changed the requirements to enable it to be more everyday appropriate. But yeah, I can see what you say in terms of, okay, well, they're doing good now, or they have been for the last 3 months. Are they actually intending to do good? So we have, especially with business lending, we have quite extensive ESG checklists. So we go over, yeah, environmental aspects, as well as the social implications within the supply chain, as well as the governance around the companies that we're lending to. And just for the big areas and industries that are of concern, such as mining, there is a lot of information that's required before we would lend money, regardless of whether or not they're wanting green funding and whether or not it's appropriate for some industries to even have green funding to them, because actually overall their implications might be horrific. So yeah, it's an interesting one to think about in terms of, are people just trying to pull the wool over your eyes so that they can get a discounted rate? But I'd say the checks that we're doing are quite robust in picking up on that, and it's a genuine concern area for us if we are to be picked up, because everything that has green assigned to it does get audited externally anyway. So they will go through it with a fine-tooth comb. So if we're not already doing that, then there is big concerns and there is big fines that will be applied to the banks. And so I guess in that, it kind of gives you a feeling that it will be done for the right reasons then, because they're being held accountable for what they're doing.
Let's take your music track. Let's have, this is a band I hadn't heard of, but you have for good reason, Jam Henderson, Easy Way Out. Why this one?
So this is actually my partner Logan's band. So he plays bass, and the lead singer as well, Sam, is a very good friend of mine who I used to flat with at university. So we're all very well connected, and they've got a new album coming out later this year, so may also be out when this podcast is out, so yeah, look out for it. But we love supporting New Zealand music, and yeah, this is Jam Henderson.
Down till beautiful sprite of the forest of Orokonui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui, kia koutou, ko tahu ahau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, and wherever you are, and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, the triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now I know that for every single person on the planet, we have been through a great upheaval, and the world that we knew and loved and trusted and took for granted changed for every single one of us. And we now find ourselves in a changed world. And for many people, this has allowed them to realize that they are in control of their lives, and they may want to live differently now. Many people are making changes in their life that they feel reflect more truly who they are and where their values sit. For others, they have wanted to continue to maintain the lives already established. But of course, having to adjust and having to make alterations and changes in order to do this. And all of this work, in whatever direction it's in, and we have some beautiful stories, of course, from this amazing show about how people are doing this. All of this work, all of this transformation requires an equal amount of restoration and rejuvenation, recuperation, rest. Because transformation, transmutation, it's a very powerful process, and it is a process that requires a lot of energy. And so I hope that for you, whatever transformations are taking place in your life, you're also having the opportunity to rest, to recuperate, to process the changes that you're making. And I really hope that you're giving yourself the opportunity to laugh, to smile, to love the process as it's happening. Even though it's challenging, to think here we are, the potuki on this earth, the children on this earth, this young species so newly evolved, surrounded by our ancient ancestors at every turn. And here we are with unique skills, unique gifts to care for the world, to make the world even better, to protect it, to nurture it. And here we are making these changes. And sometimes when we take a step back and we see the big picture like that, it can give us a sense of relief. It can remove some of the pressure that we might feel. I know for myself, with my work at Orokonui, the Eco Sanctuary has a 1,000-year plan, which of course extends far, far into the future. And it involves bringing back many species that have been lost to the valley. And I know, of course, I can just give as much as I can, and then it will outlive me. And that's a wonderful feeling. And that can be, I think at times, a helpful way to conceptualise all our lives. Takes the pressure off. So I really hope for you, you're having the opportunity to see those transformations that you're making and to feel very proud, to acknowledge your strength, to acknowledge your tenacity and determination, and to acknowledge the fact that you knew change needed to take place in your life. Of course, being part of this show is a huge pleasure and privilege. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Hannah Mason.
Hannah, we're going to listen to your podcast now. What would you like listeners to know about it?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate to sit down with my very dear friend, Amy Blake, who is doing amazing things within the farming and agricultural space. So, she's got a genuine passion for that area in particular. She's leading some incredible not-for-profits. And I think it's just listening to the podcast, you really need to think of the possibilities for New Zealand. We kind of get stuck in our ways with this is how things have been done previously. But actually, we discussed quite a few areas where there's genuine areas of concern and impact that may disrupt our food sector in general, and what you think is going to be the outcomes and how we're going to transition to make sure that we're not kind of left behind as the rest of the world is transitioning with all these disruptions occurring or set to occur.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Hannah Mason, a Master of Sustainable Business student at Otago University. And in this episode, I had the pleasure of diving into the world of food and fibre in Aotearoa with Amy Blake. Amy wears many hats. She's a sustainability consultant at Ernst & Young, co-founder of Future Farmers NZ, a charity for young Kiwis healing our world through food and fibre, and co-founder of Girls Who Grow, a charity focused on connecting young wahine in Aotearoa to Aotearoa's food system. We explore the current landscape of the food and fibre sector in Aotearoa, as well as the disruptions we can anticipate from emerging megatrends. Thank you, Amy, for joining me today. Really appreciate it. And I'm glad to have you a part of this exciting little series that we're putting together as a cohort. So yeah, just to kind of crack into it, just kind of wanted to get your insights into what we're seeing at the moment with our agricultural sector. It seems to be that our sheep and beef farmers are struggling. Weather events are impacting all agricultural farmers. Seems to be the perfect storm.
Yeah, to say it's a perfect storm is almost like a bit of an understatement. I think looking right across the value chain, we're starting to see just a number of massive mega trends really starting to hit home. Climate and farmer mental health are two things really impacting the sector. From more so a market perspective, we're definitely seeing a lot of our supply chains being shaken because a lot of the geopolitical conflicts going on in terms of fertilizer pricing, our supply chains, the Red Sea crisis and the conflict that's going on. And then also the differences in what our markets are expecting of our food and fiber producers as well. We know there's these massive trends around the climate related disclosures on net zero commitments. And then more broadly, we've also got these other big trends like AI, misinformation, as well as changing consumer demands. The threat of alternative proteins. There's been a lot of very significant change for the industry within the last wee while from the new government as well, so which creates opportunity, but I think consistent changes make things really hard for anyone trying to plan or make changes. So
definitely,
yeah.
I guess leading on with the trends piece, so I was doing a bit of research with MPI and they've came out with a report that was the future of Aotearoa New Zealand food sector, and in regards to the report itself, they were touching on global trends of local production, food and health, and tech change as kind of really big global megatrends that are impacting the future of Aotearoa's food sector. In particular, I was just wanted to get your thoughts on local food production and actually where you think the future of that looks like for Aotearoa, because at the moment it seems that everything is going against our farmers and our ag producers.
Yeah, no, it's the system, I suppose. You can talk about domestic food systems, and I think a lot of countries now, even China, all across Europe with the new European Green Deal legislation and farm to fork sort of strategy, I think they're realising, especially A, from COVID, and B, through what climate change has really highlighted, is just how vulnerable our supply chains are. Like a shake from whatever can absolutely disrupt our incredibly vulnerable supply chain. So that on a global perspective is happening, which is why you're seeing the likes of big countries investing in their own food systems and technology to feed their own country. From a New Zealand perspective, our system, because the government completely removed all subsidies in X, Y, and Z back in the 1980s, it's very market orientated, which in some ways is a real strength of our rural sector because it's meant we have adapted with the market and we're not dependent on government. But it has also meant in many ways we've just completely overlooked our domestic food system. it is absolutely crazy that despite New Zealand being, you know, one of these major food producers, we produce enough, you know, food for 40 million people, or what, that one in five children every day still goes to school hungry.
Yeah, like that, food poverty is such a real issue in a country that produces so much.
Correct. It's crazy. And not only that, like the system itself, like we've got the third highest obesity rate in the OECD. They've done research on it. We have what's called like food swamps. So in our lower socioeconomic areas, they don't have as much access to fresh or healthy food, let alone fresh or healthy food from the farmer that's probably growing it like 40 minutes down the road. Mostly because I think the middle, you know, they call it the middle kind of market between the farmers and the consumers. We've got a duopoly that do not support our local growers or small producer growers to even have a say at producing at the price or scale that these supermarkets demand. So there's a lot of big regulatory barriers there. But I have to say, in terms of New Zealand's food, like domestic food system and what the future of that look like, I think to be resilient, it needs to be relocalized, it needs to be seasonal, it needs to be community driven, and it needs to be place-based. And when I say place-based, we should be producing things on the land because it's suitable to be produced on the land there.
So what about, I guess, the move that we're starting to see towards more of a vegan or vegetarian, away from that traditional, is it meat and three veg, what our grandparents' generation, that was the norm and it was what everyone had. And with that, we're seeing alternative proteins, for example, come in, and large impact that potentially that is going to have on our farming sector.
Mm.
Have you got any insights into these alternative proteins and the benefit, but also the massive disruption they potentially could bring to our future of food?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think from a plant-based perspective, I don't know, you only have to reflect on it. Like, how many of your mates you go out to coffee with, how many of them order oat milk now? It's more common in most of my circles. It's because, obviously, with the new regulations, with Paris commitment, with, you know, all of these things, people are really starting to look at the emissions produced from food products. And given that food emissions are so massive on a global scale right across the food value chain, it's really interesting when you actually break that down and how much emissions are produced from a piece of food. Most people think that sometimes the food miles or whatever it is are the largest portion.
Mm.
In reality, they only make up maybe maximum 20%.
Right.
Depending, of course, on how you ship it or freight it, but on average, and the majority of the emissions are produced in the farm system. So that makes, when you're looking at a cropping system versus a livestock system, where livestock are obviously producing methane, the low emissions alternative is obviously the plant-based alternatives, given that most of the emissions produced on a farm level are at, you know, in the farm system. So the reason it's a real problem for somewhere like New Zealand, I mean, we're seeing now this global plant-based market. It's in kind of what's considered phase one of it. There's been these new innovations. You've got Beyond Meats, you've got whatever it is, but they're just starting to kind of take off in the initial iterations. At the moment, you can probably go to Countdown. It's considered a premium.
Mm.
You know, it's a nice to have in the likes of Hell's Pizza and these sorts of things.
Absolutely.
But there's kind of these four critical phases of innovation.
Mm.
And as soon as we start to get these other phases, it'll be at a comparable price to meat, probably a comparable nutritional value, and also even potentially a better taste.
Yeah.
And when we start to see these next iterations of the innovation, then for our meat and dairy sectors, who, I'm not going to lie, they're mostly going into commodity-based products, particularly our dairy, into whole milk powder and shipped for large miles. That's a massive risk, especially in the likes of investment in precision fermentation and all of these other things that would produce the same ingredients at a potentially lower price in the future, assuming these technologies take off the way they are. And I think the investment going into them, you'd be pretty surprised if they're not. I mean, even the likes of Fonterra are investing in precision fermentation.
Mm.
Like, it is massive. There's the likes of Daisy Lab up in Auckland. They're already doing, they're producing it in New Zealand. So it's very much not this kind of future thing. It's here and now. And so I think the critical question for New Zealand is okay, A, what does this really mean for our milk and dairy and our meat sectors, which are the majority of our primary exports? And B, how are we going to respond? respond. I think it would be silly for New Zealand to kind of, oh, we're the best at what we do in the world, we're the, you know, most efficient, and ignore these sorts of things. But as you kind of brought it back to before, I think it's really challenging when you've got the likes of Nestle, you've got the likes of Mars, Tesco, Sainsbury's, whoever it is we're sending our products to, have net zero commitments. They've got these emissions reductions, these targets they need to meet. When you go to a farmer and you say you need to reduce your emissions, when in New Zealand farmers on the grand scale are already one of the most efficient producers in the world, there's not the tools to the innovation to give, you know, methane inhibitors or whatever it is at scale yet at an economic cost. The farmers are already mentally unwell. Their farm has maybe been, you know, devastated or rocked by climate change recently. The prices, let alone
the cost of everything. Like, that's one thing, like when we're talking to our clients at the moment, yeah. Costs are through the roof, and you speak with the farmers and they're like, there is no light at the end of the tunnel right now.
I think that these, I'm not going to lie though, these innovations also do provide a massive opportunity for New Zealand in ways. We have amazing innovators and entrepreneurs and systems and the ability in this country to grow pretty much anything. You know, it's amazing. We've got pineapple farms up north at the moment. So I think allowing farmers to diversify and getting some strong leadership in this space is really required. I'm not sure that's going to come from the likes of Fonterra, but I think it's really interesting that our current system is geared to export food and fibre. What it would be really cool, and Zespri have done this quite well, is to looking at the opportunities that come from this technology, from climate technology, from food technology. What if we could not only export food and fibre, because we're great at producing those things, but export the IP, but export the genetics, but export those sorts of elements. And I think that's the opportunity for New Zealand to be a real leader in the space. But the issue with that at the moment is that our current system is not geared to produce.
And I think it was really interesting what you're saying with the IP there, because it is, like, we're known for being innovators, for coming up with ideas. Going back on the tech space, so there seems to be a lot happening at the moment, but nothing's really being upscaled at the levels that we would expect for it to come in and completely take over or replace. In Vitro Meat's academic article that I was reading, and it was talking about how the impact that they were going to have on the farmers, because actually with this new bioengineering of creating this meat from the tissues, and actually the animal welfare impacts for that, because there won't be any. It doesn't exist. We don't have to worry about that. Potentially we're going to be healthier for it if we're eating that, because we're not going to have the diseases and the likes of that exist at the moment. But yeah, the technology, it just doesn't seem to be quite there yet. What are your thoughts on this space? And is it a place that New Zealand has a place to play in?
Oh, well, that's the golden question everyone is asking at the moment, right? Because at the moment, New Zealand, I feel when we haven't explored it, there's major things going on all over the world, particularly out in the US, even within China, a lot in Singapore and happening in the space. And as I kind of mentioned before, there's normally what you see is these four key phases of innovations. And so what we're seeing at the moment now is this very early stage innovation. A lot of it's trialing, a lot of it's falling over. A lot of the products, sure, that have come out maybe still are similar, maybe don't taste as good, maybe a different nutrient profile. But as I said, the amount of money and the pace that of the investment that's going into these things could be set to significantly disrupt New Zealand's meat and dairy sectors within the next 10, 20 years. These innovations and things are very much here and now, and as you mentioned, could come with all of the likes, with no animal welfare impact, no water impact, a lot less energy, assuming the technology will ramp up. Even more localized food production. They're even now looking at precision fermentation of not just dairy products, but milk from a human, like human breast milk. The options here are endless. And I think that's what you said. New Zealand really needs to decide, okay, is this a space we want to play in? And if it is, we need to get the capital, we need to get the capabilities and the system to support that if we want to be a world leader in it. Go a hell of a long way.
Yeah, I really think that seems to tie into the mahi that you're completing with future farmers. And I think, like, looking and listening to what you are creating as a cohort is incredible. And especially just bringing in those different ideas as you speak of, and going back to traditional roots, and you've got kaisiakitanga and manaakitanga
mm-hmm.
as two core aspects that help shape everything that you're doing and the why behind it. Can you talk more about that
path forward? I think it's really coming back to connection with self, connection with others, connection with land, and really learning from our Indigenous communities, both here in Aotearoa and all over the world, is something the group are really passionate about. But the whole idea of it was, you know, we want to leave our place, leave this beautiful country in a better place than when we found it. And I think it's just so cool, and the group inspires me so much, because we get together twice a year for our huis. And the group is so diverse, but it was the foundation of the group was to foster those diverse perspectives, because we believe that if we can all come together and unite and agree on, you know, what these policies or this manifesto on the future of food and farming could be, then the rest of New Zealand can too. We purposely seek diverse views. We seek people from all across the political spectrum. We welcome both farmers on the ground and rural professionals, like, across the value chain, with that idea in mind, and it's something we actively try to make sure that we maintain. And also we're solutions focused, like, we debate things in depth, but we're not there to complain, you know, like, we're there because we care, but we're there to create solutions. And it's quite a different, you know, you need to be emotional, you need to complain, but we're, that's not the space that we're sitting in. You know, we're going somewhere, we're moving towards, you know, what we term a more united, healthy and prosperous future. But it's a future that essentially I think everyone can kind of get behind, so...
Absolutely. Awesome. So, Ames, I have got a final question that I was just wanting to kind of wind up this great discussion that we've been having. If you could change one thing right now that would make the most significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
This question is like my favorite thing to get asked. And I'm going to premise it with a bit of systems change theory, because I'm a bit of a psychological nerd, and it's how we developed our Girls Who Grow programs. But when you look at the Donella Meadows systems theory of change, she has 7 different lever points you can use to change a system. The most shallow ones being like a policy. If you create a rule, you can't go there, X, Y, and Z. And the deepest ways to make change are actually to change paradigms, to change culture, to change your relationship with that place. So if I could do one thing to make the most significant change, it would be for people just to really connect with their food and where that food has come from and understand the journey behind it. I think the potential effects, I see food as kind of this like ecological kind of like way to really connect back to ourselves as society. It's culture, it's how we share, it's how, you know, we've all come together. I think all of my biggest and favorite memories as a kid are all around the dinner table, and all the celebrations are always around kai. And so really coming back to that, I think we could both heal us and our planet. So yeah.
Fantastic. What an awesome way to finish. So thank you so much for being a part of this kōrero and just coming and sharing your wealth of knowledge with the wonderful listeners that are going to be a part of this. Yeah, thank you so much, Amy, and I look forward to seeing what the future brings in the food space for Aotearoa.
Got it.
Hannah, that was incredibly powerful and thought-provoking. What was your big takeaway from your podcast interview?
I think it was just keeping your mind open to the possibilities, because there is so much going on. And I think New Zealand's a very innovative country, and we deserve to continue to keep that title, and we need to move with the times. And whether or not that is transitioning areas of farming and agriculture for the good of everybody, yeah, just keeping your mind open to the possibilities and not being afraid of trying new things, because every time we've historically tried new things, sometimes they don't work out, but sometimes they work out for the best, and we're in pretty cool places because of it.
I think about this a lot, and certainly this podcast series of Coming Up for Air has, boy oh boy, has it really opened my mind to the need to find pathways for social change that are more effective than trying to change adults. So if it's difficult to change the mind of an adult, But if we bring our kids into the space of imagining a future, which is the kind of stuff you guys were talking about in your interview, how do we actually get that messaging out to our younger people, to your generation and the ones that are coming up behind you? How do we get that new thinking and that that future thinking into becoming the reality?
Yeah, awesome. I think it starts with the likes of the organisations that Amy's involved in, with Future Farmers, with Girls Who Grow. They're all designed to impact young individuals and be the change makers, lead the change in areas. It's so important. And I guess getting that younger generation, you get into the areas where they're kind of interested in, the likes of social media, and kind of targeting in these ways that you just start opening their minds up and getting them to think about something that they may have not been interested in or thought was very relevant to them or necessary to even think of in the first place. Like, how many people would just take for granted that we can go to a supermarket, we can get kai, and then we can take it home, we can eat it, as long as you're financially stable to do that, you wouldn't question it, versus this is, we could have some serious disruptions occur. And yeah, keeping, I think, the next generation involved in that korero at the table. I know that Future Farmers, they have put their manifesto to the government. They really are pushing for it because it's something they believe in. And I think as a younger generation, we are genuinely concerned about climate change. And so this is another area where change is going to occur, and it is for the greater good. So I guess when you think about it at that level, you're probably more likely to have that younger generation involved in those discussions and just thinking, which is exciting to me. Look at the school strikes for climate change. Like, how many years have we been doing that for now? And every year there's still kids come out in numbers, and yes, they may get today off school, but they still are using it for the good of the strike. So no, I think they're genuinely interested in making changes and for standing up for what's right and the greater good.
I have some questions to end the show, and 3 minutes to do them, so we're going to have to wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Probably two things, which are, I think are really special. The first was when my partner and I moved to Christchurch for our career progression. That was a big step. That was a big change for us. So that was awesome to do that. We've been super fortunate that we have been working for quite a long period of time. So we were able to buy our first home, which is a massive milestone as well. So we were super grateful for that. And then we've just adopted a rescue doggy who's 2.5 years old called Freya, and she's beautiful. So I think it wasn't one, but kind of that's the joy and the exciting times that I've had over the last couple of years.
What is your superpower?
My superpower, I think it's being caring. Being caring to the environment, being caring to my friends, being caring to my family, to my clients. Yeah, it's a pretty tough world out there, so being caring, definitely. Good superpower to have.
People go on about trying to find different theories about the connection between economics and the environment and various other things, but I think you've just nailed it, that it's being caring across all of them. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Probably not, I think. And I guess that's kind of the same with the whole feminist as well. I'm like, I probably don't put the title on, but the actions that I have probably do align with both of those things. So maybe I'll turn that answer around to a yes, but not at the level that I'm probably associated with it.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Just life. It's pretty good out there when you look at the wider world and how pretty horrible it is. And I'm pretty fortunate. I've got great people around me. I enjoy my job, which is few and far between with the younger generation these days. So yeah, I'm very fortunate to do something that I find meaning in. And yeah, the life that I'm living, I'm loving. So can't really complain. So it's worth getting out of bed for.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
No. No, probably not. Probably changes given the context of what it's being discussed in. I don't think off the top of my head I could probably knuckle it down to just one line.
What is the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I think it's time for me to move into a different role within the company I work for. Yeah, I think the time's ready for me to kind of step up and start making more impactful decisions. At the moment, I assist clients, but I think to actually be making a lot of those decisions, the time is now. And yeah, it'd be great to be assisting more and more companies to be sustainable or already sustainable companies to get to the level that they need to, because it's awesome to see the work that's going on out there.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, I think it is just to, as I've said, be mindful, be caring, be thoughtful and just thought-provoking. Think of everything that's happening, do your little bit to create wider impact, whatever that looks like. And yeah.
Thank you for that. Mawira.
Hannah, thank you very much for your contribution to our shared learning space over the course of these papers, and especially for your podcast, which was incredibly heartening for me. I sometimes get a bit overwhelmed by the negativity of the world, but then something like your podcast comes along and just lifts me back up again into thinking, yep, it's all going to be okay. And also, thank you very much just for your brightness and your very positive view of the world that you brought to our classroom as well, and to your relationships with everybody. You talk about caring for people. That's evident in your whole practice, not just your professional practice, but the way that you write, your contribution in the classroom setting, and especially here today too. Thank you very much for your kindness, and thank you for sharing with us today. Good luck for the future.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
Thank you. Now, I looked for something, a song that would mix both future farming and the bank. So it's Johnny Cash, get the bank, Johnny Cash, Farmer's Almanac.
Fabulous.
Well, the farmer prayed for a better year, and the crops were good like the Lord did here, but his barn burned down with winter near. The answer came in white and black in the Farmer's Almanac. It says, if a man could have half his wishes, he could double his trouble. A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back. And it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land, and when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little offbeat and a little off track, but it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook as well.
The little boy followed the honeybee, and it flew straight to the honey tree. He got stung but got the honey free. Consolation for the things you lack is in the farm.
We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. Hannah Mason provided our coming up for air contribution, and that is who we've been talking with. With Mawira Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show.
And it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, lies have to be covered up, truth can run around naked.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.